Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Beware, spoiler folks. You've stumbled across a storm of spoilers. This week, our second podcast that isn't based on previously published material.
Oh, you stink of illiteracy!
If you must blink, do it now. Pay careful attention to everything you see. No matter how unusual it may seem. If you look away, even for an instant, then our hero will surely perish.
I keep telling you, Neil. I like to be alone.
So do I. Let's do it together.
It's time to follow my own path. My name is Kubo.
You dare disobey your mother!
Your magic is growing stronger. But when we grow stronger, the world grows more dangerous.
What if our world is just like a tiny speck?
A tiny little speck.
And there are giants looking down on us.
And every time we move,
it's actually them moving us.
Seems a bit tedious.
Like that, just there, me blinking. That would have taken them a day.
Me moving my arm. 500 men.
None of them are going home. They're having to do this bit.
I think it throws up notions of free will.
It's too much.
You got my attention. I promise I won't even blink. I actually don't think I even can blink. Do I have eyelids?
Hello and welcome to A Storm of Spoilers off season tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and my favorite character from a Leica film is Neil from Paranorman, because he's great.
I'm Joanna Robinson. My favorite character from a Leica film is Fish from Box Trolls, voiced by Dee Bradley Baker.
And I'm Neil Miller, and my favorite character from a Leica movie is actually two characters. It's Mr. Trout and Mr. Pickles from The Box Trolls, voiced by Nick Frost and Richard Ayoade. I think that their closing credits thing is by far the best one so far.
I happened to rewatch Coraline in preparation for this episode, and although I enjoyed it more than I remembered liking it, still not my favorite. But we're all going to discuss that and more, especially Kubo and the Two Strings, the newest stop-motion masterpiece from Leica, a company that makes stop-motion films. They feel tactile sometimes. This one especially felt, I think, closer to CGI than they've ever been able to get because of new 3D printing methods. All facts and opinions that are waiting for you deeper in this podcast. But first, you're listening to A Storm of Spoilers, and each week my co-hosts take a portion of the podcast to do their own little meta-mote things. Joanna, do we have any reviews or anything?
Yes, I've got some very, very exciting positive words to read out to you right now. Goes like this. Shit gets real. I'd stop preparing yourselves now. Scratch that. Nothing will prepare you for this. Holy balls! No, that's not a review of Storm of Spoilers. That's our very own Maisie Williams tweeting about Game of Thrones Season 7, which we'll talk about a little bit more in Neil's section. We actually did not get any new reviews. So if you want to leave us something very hyperbolic and exclamatory in the manner of Maisie Williams on Twitter over on iTunes, we would so appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, Joanna really, she digs deep on these and always comes ready to read them before the show. So
yeah.
Please,
I do a lot of research.
Give her something to read next week.
Meanwhile, Neil, even though Joanna bled into yours a little bit, what's happening in Game of Thrones this week?
Oh, man. We got a big ol' raven from the Citadel this week. Really, we need to talk about two people. The first thing is we need to talk about where Jason Momoa was, which is in Ireland. And this is something that I wrote about on Film School Rejects, his trip to Belfast, where he was spotted taking pictures with Dan Weiss, David Benioff, and kind of near the set. So obviously the whole Game of Thrones-a-sphere started churning up what it is this could be. I came up with some ideas myself. The most plausible one, I guess, from a Game of Thrones standpoint was that he maybe is going to appear in a flashback, and he was there for a costume fitting, because it would have been a couple of years since he would have been fitted for a costume. So, you know, and after Aquaman, maybe he either gained or lost a couple pounds. You never know. My other guess, which I had five of them, I'm not going to do them all here. One of my other,
but please do read that post because it's amazing. Yeah.
Thank you. My number five, which I actually thought at the time was just kind of a weird shot in the dark, which is he tagged at Guinness, the brand, in his original post, and I was like, he could also be there doing something for Guinness. And it turns out days later that that's exactly what he was there for. They launched a Guinness flavor. It doesn't matter what it's called. But basically they launched a beer where he is the spokesperson for the beer. So unfortunately it appears as if Jason Momoa is not, as of now, involved in Game of Thrones. He is just there to drink with friends and promote Guinness.
If you haven't seen that photo, though, you should, because, like, I think it's Dan Weiss has, like, the best, like, this guy exasperated expression on his face as Momoa is, like, mugging for the camera. It's
yeah,
pretty
the good news is this year we get a little, within days, we now have some confirmation of what he was there for. We're not going to get shade again like we did last year, so.
Well, yeah, shade. And I have to imagine that if you were there for a flash, I mean, they're trying to be so secretive, right? That if you were there for some sort of flashback, they wouldn't then let him post a photo on Instagram.
I guess that's a question.
Unless the whole Guinness sponsorship is a double blind. Because usually when we see photos of cast members in and around the set on Instagram, it's like randos who have run into them and have been like, can we please take a photo with you? And then you get like Art Parkinson on Instagram. That's a Leica tie-in reference. But, you know, but I just don't think that they would let the actors themselves post it.
Maybe that's something we're going to find out here in the next, probably not next month, but the month after. Probably in October, we'll find out how secretive they want to be this year. I don't know if they have to be as secretive.
I know. They could just let it go.
They could just let it go. There's no cliffhangers from last season. No, nothing major. I mean, there's no one's fate is hanging in the balance. And the likelihood that a book is coming out before the season anyway is much higher this year than it was last year. So we'll see. But the other thing.
But as you pointed out in the Momoa post that you wrote, or actually I think it was like a Twitter response, was if we find out that Sean Bean is up there.
Oh, yeah. No, that's definitely.
Like, I feel like that's something they would want to keep under wraps. Right. Like they would throw a tarp on him on the plane or something.
Right. Like I think there's a couple people. Sean Bean, Michelle Fairley.
Right.
Maybe what's his name? Play Robert Baratheon. If they end up in any kind of flashback,
Mark Abbey?
Yeah. So if they end up in a flashback, that's something they may want to, or like a real scene, Michelle Fairley, then they'd want to keep that secret. But beyond that, it's like no one cares that Kit Harington's there. Like, obviously he's there, you know, there's no hair watch this year. So.
Lame.
Thank God.
All right.
Whose hair am I supposed to watch?
What's your other thing?
So, also in the loose lips category is what you were talking about earlier, which is we know that some of these people have received their scripts because they are talking about it, and we need to talk about what Maisie Williams tweeted.
Yeah. Just to recap, she tweeted, just finished reading season 7, shit gets real, all caps on real, I start preparing yourselves now, scratch that, nothing will prepare you for this, holy balls, all caps on balls. So, emphasis on the balls.
I think I disagree with her a little bit. We have had 6 seasons to prepare us for this, so I feel like we're pretty well prepared.
I have a hard time buying into hyperbole from anyone who's directly involved in anything. I mean, it's just like, of course, that's what you would say, right? Like,
yeah.
And that's fine.
That's what I tell people about this podcast, you know? All the time. I'm like, you guys will not believe what we said.
Holy balls. Yeah. Holy balls, this podcast. So I don't know. Like, every season, the actors say this is the best, craziest, whatever season ever. And they might be right, but like, I don't know. Anyway, what does Maisie mean? She dies. Sophie Turner dies. I don't know. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, probably. What else would she say when... I mean, what does she think shit gets real means to a Game of Thrones fan? What's real? Is it, like, dragons? Or is it... She seems to be, like, somewhat on a barometer because she predicted we'd find her storyline boring this season. So maybe, you know, real is probably death. I'm on your side. Someone big's gonna die.
I feel like there's like a top three things that it could mean. Number one is Arya's death, like her own character dying. Right. Number two is Arya meets Daenerys. And number three is Arya kills someone we like. Those would be my three shit gets real Arya things.
I think it's the third one. I really have to say. Mm-hmm. Like
you think she kills Sansa or?
Yeah, she kills someone big, and like it like I think it's going to be such, and we've speculated about this before, right, that Arya comes back in her assassin capacity and kills someone, crosses a line, but I think it's going to be a murder that it will be hard for us to reconcile how much we like her character with who she kills.
Mm.
So I'm not saying it's Jon necessarily, but like, I don't know, Jaime or something like that.
Davos.
Davos.
Yeah.
What does she have against Davos? What does anyone have against Davos?
Mm. What does anyone need to have against anyone in that show?
It's all a whole bunch of characters being morally ambiguous to each other, which
right.
I feel like is the exact opposite of what we're talking about this week.
Good segue. Let's do
yes,
it.
Yes, which is of course the magical worlds of like stop motion films. Those at this point consist of four: Coraline, Paranorman, The Box Trolls, and Kubo and the Two Strings. The previous three have all gotten nominated for Best Animated Feature at the Academy Awards. I guarantee you the fourth one will back that up. I think that's an easy call, even in this year of animation dominance at the box office. Craft is still important. That's how Annalisa got nominated last year.
Animation domination was right there, just waiting for you.
Yes. That's true. That's also a company, I think.
Oh, is it?
Wait, is it a company or just a Sunday night thing on Fox?
Animation domination.
I think it's also important to note some of Laika's origins as mm-hmm. When they were just an animation house, and after they were bought by Phil Knight, who is the Nike co-founder and chairman, and his son Travis, who directed Kubo, which we're going to talk about. They also did contract work on Corpse Bride, Tim Burton's Corpse Bride, directed not by Tim Burton, but Henry Selick. And they did the stop motion claymation segment of a very Harold and Kumar 3D Christmas, which I found interesting. That movie is just balls out insane, and that sequence is really great. So that also a Laika thing, apparently.
Yeah. I think maybe they haven't shut down their complete farming out thing. I think it's called Laika/House. Is there commercial division?
They had a commercial division called Laika House, and now it's just called House Special. So they have it's separate from Laika Entertainment, which, interestingly, this year or last year, I can't remember exactly when this was, they talked about expanding, because the movies you listed, Coraline was in 2009, Paranorman was in 2012, Box Trolls was in 2014, Kubo's this year. They've expanded the Laika Entertainment side production space so that they can do one movie a year going forward.
Oh, cool.
Which is very cool.
I hope that Nike money just floods them forever, because as we were discussing off air, Kubo, which is a great movie, I would say it's probably my second favorite Laika movie after Box Trolls, which I just loved a lot, is tanking the box office. Yeah,
so far,
if you're listening to this and you haven't seen it, turn off the podcast, go see it, then come back and listen to us chat about it. This is your homework. And if you didn't do your homework this weekend, you have to go do it now. Or go see it again. Take someone, go see it. It's so charming, and it's just really distressing when garbage fires like Suicide Squad get so much money, and Laika films, which are painstaking to make. If you stay through the end credit sequence of Kubo, you get to see some of their work in there. And, you know, Neil has been watching, I think, some footage. Like, there's plenty of making of things, and you see how much work goes into these beautiful films, and how original the storytelling is. And then you just, when I was watching, I'm sorry, I'm probably getting off track, but
keep going. You're good.
It was just, there's just like one moment in Kubo when Kubo and his two sidekicks, which are a monkey and a beetle man, like walk into a cavern. And I was like, this is the making of a new fairy tale, right? Like that in this era of remakes and rehashes and stuff like that, like, you know, yeah, Laika adapted Neil Gaiman's book Coraline, but they're also producing these new stories and this new iconography, which I just think is so rare and should be valued. So
yeah I
agree, and their storytelling method I think is starting to develop some characteristics that beyond stop motion make them sort of like a film. Like, you always have a very strong child character, and then you always have sort of a heartfelt series of monologues that close out the film. And even though that sounds like a horrible way to make like an animated movie, it is consistently fantastic as they find like sort of different iterations. I think of like the same structure, it's the same like loose structure to tell different themes. And because they're really good at pairing themes with subject matter, it ends up, I mean, being very effective in what they're trying to focus on.
And it's something we should say for you Game of Thrones nerds, is that they seem to like Game of Thrones kids, right? Because Art Parkinson is the voice of Kubo, and Isaac Hempstead Wright was the voice of Eggsy in Box Trolls. And both those voice performances, I think, are better than anything those two boys have done on Game of Thrones. That's not really, like, I'm not really knocking them even that hard. I just think, like, their, like, a voice work is so good. That, you know, if you're still listening to this and you haven't seen Kubo, turn off the podcast and go see
it. It's amazing because I think every one of their movies has a Game of Thrones-ish person. Ian McShane was in Coraline.
Yes.
What was the
Paranorman might be the outlier.
Paranorman
might be the outlier.
Ian McShane's accent in Coraline is pretty delightful. I was rewatching that, Dave said that he rewatched that recently. I rewatched it, I don't know, last week, 2 weeks ago. And, it's a weird tone. It's their first film, and it's darker, I think, than their subsequent films. Not that these films, their later films, I really respect for grappling with mature themes in the context of children entertainment. Like, Kubo's all about, like, death and letting go.
Yes.
It's pretty striking. But Coraline is very dark and creepy. Starts off creepy, gets creepier. But Ian McShane's accent, Russian Slavic accent, is a highlight.
And you know
for
what
me.
I think was interesting about Coraline? That they really did... The magic of that is they took an existing novel... existing, you know, text that was pretty famous, Neil Gaiman. And they used it as almost like a showreel movie. Like, I remember for the first time, this is back in 2009, being really caught off guard by how great the 3D was. Like, it was like looking through a picture window at all times. And so that's, they really use Coraline as kind of their breakout. Like, this is what our technology, this is what our craftsmanship can deliver. And they've been sort of riding that high ever since. And they've used that to make some really interesting original-ish stories in their three later movies. So I think it's a really cool moment in kind of cinematic history when they made Coraline because of what it means going forward.
And I think like what it had to be ultimately affects Coraline looking back at it. Because there's it's a Henry Selick movie, which is basically just saying, hey, Nightmare Before Christmas, if you like that, check this out. Except instead of Tim Burton, we got Neil Gaiman, which is fine. But then it sort of seeps into the design decision in the sense that the whole climax with the other mother is in a high contrast, like spider web that is flat looking in 2D. When in 3D, it was absolutely amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like, and also they're trying to create wonder, I think, at a certain extent, or atmosphere at the expense of pace, which they also have this trouble in other movies, but I feel it really drags for me at some points in Coraline, especially when I get ahead of the plot, which happens to me in some of these movies. It happened to me in Kubo and the Two Strings, which I think we should pivot hard to now because it is a really interesting movie.
Well, they're very simple movies. I think it's easy to get ahead of them.
Yes.
I think that's what makes them accessible to kids is that while they are dark and they're dealing with some very adult themes, they're also super simple. So kids can follow them like Kubo. Kubo starts as essentially the tale of a kid taking care of his mother, who essentially has Alzheimer's. Like, her mind is going, and she is sort of zonked out, but comes back to, you know, more vivacious moments, and they're storytellers. And I think that's a really sort of universal thing between different age groups that you can understand, which is, you know, taking care of a family member.
We're going to talk about, I agree with Neil, and I'm going to give a really unnecessary warning, which is that there are two heavily telegraphed reveals in Kubo that we're going to spoil, because remember, this is Storm of Spoilers. So Dave, I think this is what you want to talk about, right?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is with Kubo is that it rewards the things I like about Game of Thrones, like, thematically, while completely frustrating the things I like about following franchise culture and rules in fictional worlds, because...
And withholding information?
No, not necessarily withholding information, because there's, you know, magical enchantments, and there's, like, some sort of... But that's what I'm talking about, is that it makes up its rules as it goes along. Like, the villagers are amazed that Kubo can, you know, do this magic with the origami paper, but no one ever stops and says, like, is he the only one that could do it, or whatever. Like, that's something that we figure out later in the story. So as it goes along, when it reveals that the two sidekicks that he has, the monkey voiced by Charlize Theron and the beetle voiced by Matthew McConaughey, are actually cursed versions of his parents, I guess would be the best way to put it. It makes you, like, when you catch on to that as an audience, which I think for, at least for Joanna and I, maybe also for Neil, was as soon as you hear the monkey talk and you realize it's also Charlize Theron's voice coming out of it.
Yeah, the monkey was easy.
They're at least doing a simple metaphor, and then by the time the beetle and the monkey start flirting, you start to realize that maybe that's actually where the story's going to start going.
Well, before that, the origami version of Hanzo looks like very much like the beetle, like, you know, like he's got those giant antlers. And later when the sister does her like creepy reveal and she refolds the paper like from Hanzo into the beetle, I'm like, that didn't change that much though. So like I was suspicious right away that he was the dad.
I guess I was suspicious, but I didn't catch it until much later. I think the film did a slightly better job of hiding that one.
I did like when he was like, I was his servant. I was like, that's right. A pretty good cover. That's a good cover for him to like have the iconography, but maybe not be Hanzo. And I think maybe if they had wanted to hide it, which I just don't think they did care that much about hiding it, but if they had wanted to hide it, they could have shown us Hanzo's like death, supposed death at the beginning or something like that. Like, cause we just have hearsay for him dying. Mm-hmm. And if you don't see them die, I don't believe they're dead. and I guess the last thing I'll say is that, you know, if it's not a big deal reveal, then we don't need Rooney Mara like gloating and dragging it out at the end. Do you know? Like,
I do think so. There's a, you know, from a plot standpoint, the question is it important that it's a reveal to the audience as much as it is important that it's a reveal to the character? You right. know, like the movie is
all three characters.
Yeah. I mean, the movie is hiding it from the characters, but they're not hiding it from us. Like the mother and the monkey thing is a perfect example of like the movie doesn't seem to care that we get it, but it is a reveal. Right. It is an emotional moment later for the other two characters.
Yeah, I actually really like the way the monkey stuff was done. I think the dad stuff was like slightly not as smooth, but like,
well, as soon as the light doesn't show up at the grave, right? We know he's not an asshole, so that he's just like he's alive somewhere.
I mean, maybe he's an asshole. I don't know.
Before we met the beetle, I thought the light didn't show because he was like, I don't know, late, and then he was just like in the origami, like because Kubo didn't properly like put him on his way. I thought he was just like in the origami Hanzo, but that's another double blind, right? That there's like two Hanzos rolling around because there's like paper Hanzo and then beetle Hanzo. So
well, that's what I was talking about. Is there isn't any rules to the magic. There's just magic and this story that's actually about, you know, dealing with the death of your parents and loved ones. But plot wise, you know, it just takes this very simple samurai journey with this one twist, which is, you know, his parents are with him. But like, I don't even know if that's a twist. If you were telling this as a fairy tale, I think you would, you know, manage to pull that off as a surprise. But I don't know if that would be as touching as the moment I realized it when he's sitting in between them. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I've never had a dinner in between two people. I'm like, oh my God, those are his parents.
So sad. It's so sad.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, the movie knows that it's going to get you emotionally regardless of when you pick it up.
Yeah, you know, I think that's true.
The movie knows that ending is going to have emotional resonance regardless of whether or not you saw it coming, because it's so beautifully done.
I have to say, I got actually more emotional about the villagers being nice to Ray Fiennes than I did about the parent reveal, when that was just like the solution of like, we've defeated the Moon King and now we're going to rewrite his story and make him think he's a really nice guy. I don't know why that really got me.
Well, I think because that's like, the other big thematic idea of this movie is that it's about a child dealing with the loss of his parents, but it's also about this cosmic battle between, you know, would you rather live immortally and not know pain, essentially, and not know suffering, or would you rather be a human and experience the full range of emotions that humanity gets to experience? And is there good in humanity, which is a very like, if that's what felt very like Akira Kurosawa to me, is like these ruminations on just the nature of goodness in the human spirit. And I think that you're right, that resonates really, really well with Kubo.
And also like that sorrow and loss is the price you pay for warmth and love, right?
Right.
That's the other side of that coin that you have to deal with. I really do, like, reveal or not aside, I really love the characterization of Matthew McConaughey's character, because he was both like dumb sidekick and believable romantic interest, because like the story we hear eventually is that Charlize Theron's character left her, you know, moon goddess status because he was just like warm and loving, which he is no matter how stupid he is, which he's pretty stupid, you know. And then her sisters like disdain him. Like, he's just the perfect embodiment of clumsy humanity, because he's not sharp. I mean, he's a good fighter, but he's not sharp, but he's just like so warm and loving.
So you weren't like, why is Buzz Lightyear in this movie the whole time?
is that how you felt? Why is Buzz Lightyear in this
movie?
I feel
like there's nothing that Matthew McConaughey did in this role that Tim Allen couldn't do in this role.
I do feel like that he was my least favorite voice in the film. And I mean, this is, I guess, where we can talk about race if we want to, which I do, which is to say that, you know, this is not just like an Asian-ish story. Like they talk about samurais. This is a Japanese story. And our three protagonists, four, if you want to count Rooney Mara, are all supposed to be Asian. And they are voiced by white people. George Takei is in the movie,
right?
But barely. I mean, he says, "Oh my!" So you know
I think
it's
he's
him.
Like
but like
fourth build, actually,
he is. No, he is. Like in the credits, George Takei is way up there, but he has like four lines. Like that lady villager. Like that makes me think that they want us to be like, "Oh hey, they've got an Asian dude in there." I mean, he like barely talks. Like it's anyway. Our colleague over in Fighting the War Room, David Ehrlich. When I brought this up, this question up, when we talked about the movie before I had seen it over on Fighting the War Room, he was like, well, Charlize Theron's character is a monkey and Matthew McConaughey's character is a beetle, so it doesn't really matter who voices them. But...
I mean, it's because you didn't want to spoil you.
But... I mean, Charlize Theron is freaking great. She's so great. But, like, you know, an Asian actress could have been really great as well. So... I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts?
It's hard to argue with the people who want to see themselves and their background portrayed on screen, but I also find it difficult to ding this movie too much because it's so visually and culturally feels authentic that the voice thing, I don't know. It's like if the villagers came across as like, you know, Zootopia inhabitants or Shrek, you know, Fantasy Kingdom inhabitants, then yes, that's horrible. But it feels like a lot of care was taken even to design the exterior sets so they echo, you know, different Japanese art, whether it be origami or wood carving. So at that point, if we're talking about like eight characters and you cast Ralph Fiennes as the villain and I have to like argue against that, it's hard, man. I feel like I'm really torn between those issues.
I think I'm with
Matthew McConaughey, though, would have been great. Just throw in any Asian actor. Just do it.
I feel like this is you know, it's a tough one because you want I would understand if somebody, you know, of Japanese descent saw this movie and said like, why are there a bunch of white people voicing these?
Like why does one of them sound like a cowboy? Right. Like at least Charlize Theron doesn't sound like a cowboy.
I do think that there is something to the earnestness of Laika's production that, you know, there's the art and commerce of it. The art of it, the painstaking art of creating the world of Kubo, they went to such amazingly great lengths to make it authentic and real. There is an element of, you know, having to make it commercially viable for audiences in the United States. Sometimes that means some famous actors in the United States. You know, that means maybe having Matthew McConaughey on the red carpet. I know that's not a perfect answer because there are plenty of movies that have succeeded with, you know, no-name actors who are culturally better fits for their roles. But I think that you really have to appreciate the detail that they put into it visually. And, you know, if somebody's not happy with Charlize Theron and Art Parkinson as the leads, that's totally fine. It doesn't bother me, but I have less skin in that particular game. So I guess I just understand if anyone is mad.
Oh, understand. That was the word I forgot to put like
I can thing. I can empathize, but like
oh, yeah. That one too. God damn it.
Another point I think that David Ehrlich brought up, or someone brought up, was that, you know, when Miyazaki films are dubbed into English, they often get American or British stars, mm-hmm. known names, like what Anne Hathaway was in one, right? Or, well, Emily Mortimer's not a great example. But anyway, or Gillian Anderson, I'm trying to think of Miyazaki voice right. actors, you know, like who they use. But in Box Trolls, you know, you've got Ben Kingsley and Toni Collette, like Jared Harris, like these aren't huge stars. So it does feel mm-hmm. like Travis Knight made the decision that he did want those bigger names in this production than maybe they've leaned on in the past. They've always had good actors' names we recognize, but maybe not above the title marquee.
Yeah, and
names,
I do think that they think about it less from, and whether this is right or wrong is up for debate, but I do think they just feel like who fits the part correctly. Like who is, you know, like Tracy Morgan is a voice in the Box Trolls, and the Box Trolls is an essentially Scandinavian
Bavarian
movie.
It's
based on like Norwegian and Swedish culture where people believe in trolls and love cheese and stuff. You know, so you have this kind of crossover where they seem to be just looking for whoever feels right and is also maybe a recognizable name. You know, like you said before, McConaughey does kind of feel right for bumbling humanity as the Sam Beetle. And I think Charlize Theron is great as the monkey. She's got that tough cadence when she needs to have it, which is what made her great as Furiosa, and it's what makes her great as an overly protective monkey.
When she was like fighting Tooth and Claw, her sister on the sinking ship, I was just like, man, this is the most Furiosa moment. I don't want to say Charlize is our only actress who could do this, but man, she's so great at that. She's so great at just like snarling and fighting.
And like Rooney Mara has a creepy voice in the context that they use her in this movie as the two sisters.
It doesn't sound like they do much more besides double her voice, which means that's like the most expressive I've ever heard Rooney Mara sound delivering the line.
I really wish David were here.
That's the big question, is if it feels right for the movie, the tone, the narrative they're trying to tell, if it feels like it accomplishes it, that doesn't necessarily excuse what we would call appropriation by a bunch of white actors. But it does make it easier to kind of get past on a wider level, I think.
I will say, like, I think it looks better, not looks better, but just is better when you have, like, Ming-Na Wen voicing Mulan. But then again, you have Donny Osmond as the male lead in that movie. But, you know, like, it just, and, like, the most obvious names are coming to my mind when I think about this. But, like, there are just great actors of every race, obviously, we all know that. And so I don't think it would be too hard for them to find Asian actors. And like, if they want above the marquee names, like, we're not going to get Asian actors who have above the marquee names if they aren't cast in roles in films.
Sure.
Do you know? So,
yeah. So I guess what we really need is if we have a listener out there who is of Japanese descent and has seen Kubo, tweet at us and let us know what you think, because we're just three white people. Well, two, and then most of Dave.
Also, if you're a Japanese listener and you're tweeting at us, you should also email us what you thought about Shin Godzilla, because I'm going mad over here and I don't have a release date. Like, seriously, it's hurting my soul.
You can email us stormofspoilers@gmail.com.
Yeah.
And while you're doing all these things, you really should leave us a review on iTunes. Right.
And Joanna will not read it in your accent unless you say so.
Oh my God. Nope. Not even if they say so.
Shin Godzilla is actually a good example, because I hear it's chock full of like all notable like Japanese actor faces, even if it doesn't necessarily need to be. Like, they'll be like weird officials and whatnot just to like be like, here's our Godzilla. And then America sort of like, idiots, man, I can't wait for this movie. It's gonna be great.
Here's a big question, speaking of Japanese actors. I think the one thing that kind of bothered me was, why did we get a George Takei-ism where he goes, oh my.
Oh,
but
my.
We didn't get any McConaughey-isms. We didn't get any
you want
all
the
right,
Beatle
all right,
to go all right, all right, all right.
Yeah, or I just want the Beatle to be like, just keep living.
I just wanted George Takei not to say, oh my, but because I was like, so when good. That happened, I was like, come on.
Well, and here's, so here's a good example. For. So there's this little old woman who Kubo bonds with in the village, and she's voiced by
that character.
She's voiced by Brenda Vaccaro, who is, to my knowledge, not Japanese. Right. She is from New York, but she's fantastic in that role.
She's really good.
She just sells it as this kind of loopy old woman who is like Kubo's best friend. She's exactly the kind of character that you would imagine a magical child befriending when he has like no one else to talk to. So yeah, that's a thing.
Part of my part of what I really liked about that character is they've updated their 3D printing technique so that now they could do more what we'd call like in between frames in traditional animation, but now they're more faces in between expressions. And when she starts to like tell jokes or ask for a flame throwing chicken, or when that flame throwing chicken shows up, that lady's face might be my favorite Laika face.
Nice.
And
so good.
Executed.
So that's a good segue. We should talk about the craftsmanship that goes into
hell yeah,
movies,
we should.
Which I think is, if you've ever stayed to the end of a Laika movie, you usually get treated to a little bit of, I guess, like a mini featurette at the end of the credits where it shows the animators and how they actually work. My favorite one is the box trolls.
For some reason, I thought I stayed through the box troll, but I've seen it so many times, and I don't remember ever staying for that. Sorry.
So the
ahead.
Box trolls ends.
Isn't there's like a, there's a whole song with box trolls, right?
Well, yeah, but the box trolls ends with them, it shows the animator, like the animator's uh-huh. moving really fast, but it's Mr. Pickles and Mr. Trout talking about like having this existential conversation about what if there's someone controlling them. And they're like, what? See, if I jump, then someone had to move me. And
what?
And oh, it becomes this like just amazing thing where they're questioning the higher power as you can see the animator moving them, and it goes by very quickly, like it's a time lapse. So it's amazing. And I believe I didn't stay till the end of Kubo, but I believe there's one at the end of Kubo as well where they show.
Yeah, it's the skeleton.
Oh, it's a skeleton. About, okay.
Yeah, this one's about like scale. So it's a long pullback of the skeleton creature that they have. They built it as like a large animatronic that they could move frame by frame,
mm-hmm.
but it's like as tall as a person, just its torso.
That's
and
awesome.
It's like its glowing eyes are light bulbs. Like that's the scale of it. It's mm-hmm. pretty amazing.
Yeah. And then you have a guy, the puppeteer is in a green sock sitting behind sort of articulating it. But there's also these like, crane sort of apparati or marionette sort of things on its arms as it's moving. It's really cool. The scale of that is really cool because like whenever I think about stop motion and I'm just now looking at a GIF of what you were describing at the end of Box Trolls, like that's about the size I think. And so the fact that skeleton is so big, I mean, I guess it makes sense if their regular characters have to be small in scale compared to it, mm-hmm. but, yeah, it's cool. It's really cool. Laika's so cool, man. I mean, I would like Aardman. I love stop motion. Aardman, which does, you know, Wallace and Gromit and stuff like that. Like they're in Chicken Run, right? They did Chicken Run.
Mm-hmm.
I think their stuff is so cool, but Laika's just like on another level, man.
Well, and I think, you know, the big difference to me is, you know, you get like Wallace and Gromit and what was the one they came out with recently about the...
The were-rabbit?
No, not the
were-rabbit. Oh, no, no. Oh, Shaun the Sheep?
Shaun the Sheep.
Shaun
yeah,
the Sheep.
That was adorable.
Yeah.
But the claymation is, like, you make the figure, and it's a single figure, and that's it. You know, you make a couple different versions of the figure, depending on what they're doing. But with Laika, you have... I remember doing press for Coraline, and they talked about how they made all these different costumes, these miniature costumes. Like, the costume designer still makes all the costumes, but... they make them like smaller than the size of your hand. So they have costume changes, and they have different faces, and they have different eyes, and it's all miniaturized. It is amazing. And to think that they did that all pretty much by hand, like in the Coraline time. And now Dave could probably speak to this more, but the 3D printing technology that they have is apparently amazing.
Yeah. So basically, if you want to do a stop motion 3D printing like a style, you have your armature stop motion figure and its face snaps off. Occasionally the Animalisa, they left in the lines so you could see for those characters, it sort of looked like eyeglass lines where their face would snap off. And then he, of course, in the movie, he takes part of it off and you could see the armature underneath. But they take the voice track and then put it through some lip sync software. And then a character or a designer will design what each, you know, face shape looks like. And then a computer will run through the face shapes in between those things. And then each one of those face shapes is printed out and filed. And so each time something in the face needs to change, the animator will snap off the faceplate and look at the corresponding number on his X sheet, which is an exposure sheet if they still use it, which I imagine they do, because otherwise it'd be insane. And you just, you know, this, you know, frame 3062 is face, you know, 62A. Click it in, take a picture, and you do it all over again. And it's
amazing.
It could take hours and hours and hours to make a second. I think it's about a second a day is what they were doing for Paranorman. They might be faster now because I hear 3D printing's better. But it looks like they just made everything more complex for themselves, because this one is all textured the same. Whereas like Paranorman's design had like, you know, angles at weird ways and all the characters had like ears that weren't even. All of these are made to have a wood texture, even if it's not paper or somebody's skin. So that plus the more in between frames has they're able to like 3D print textures on these things and therefore mass produce textures. So it's been saving painting time and whatnot. So this one, I think, gets as close to looking at what something like at the beginning of this, because there's some CG stuff that's been added, like, you know, spray in the ocean and whatnot. And because it starts on the ocean, which is a really bold move for a stop motion animated movie.
Yeah.
The entire time I was looking for something to give me scale, that these were miniatures or that these were big. It's like even with like Box Trolls and Coraline and Paranorman, they're immediately placed in like a realistic context somehow. You know, they're crawling through a door. That's two movies. Or they're, you know, in a suburban neighborhood. But this one, it doesn't really stop to give you scale until you're in the village, because otherwise it's just these two little things against these like undulating effects or gigantic well-lit mountains that you can't tell if they're paintings or if they're sets. So the fact that it took me so long to orient size in this animated movie means I think that we're like crossing the uncanny valley of still real life 2CG, which, I mean, it's probably sad for somebody, but it's amazing that you can absolutely control every little thing in real life now, not just in a computer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that that's one of the things that surprised me about Kubo. Is I watched some of the behind the scenes, and as someone who's been watching every behind the scene featurette that has ever existed for Leica, this is the first time that I've seen them use significant green screen. And it's mostly in this movie for background, you know, I would imagine it's a lot of the water effects. That was one thing as I was watching the movie. I didn't watch the featurettes till afterward, but you know, watching the movie, I'm like, how did they do the water? You know, because I remember I went for a press thing, to ILM for the movie Battleship, which is not one of my proudest moments, but it was cool because I get to go to ILM.
It's the best movie.
but I remember them talking about how they, for that movie, which was not that long ago, this was what, 2012, they invented a new technology for CG animated water. Like they had to rebuild water, like how they animated water from the ground up in order to accommodate this Peter Berg movie with, you know, what's his name? And
that's so interesting.
Yeah. So I remember them talking about how hard that was. And then I see Kubo and I'm like, how the hell did they do that?
Yeah, because they're not trying to make like real water. It's like designed water that feels like real water. It's amazing. I'm sorry, I cut off Joanna.
Oh, no, I was just going to say my friend used to do only water for ILM. And like she worked on the Pirates movies and like Evan Almighty, like a weird movies like that. But her only job was water. So just think about that. Like next time you see a movie that there's someone who just does water and that's all.
Yeah, I mean, depending on the movie, there might be a whole team of people that just do water.
Oh, yeah, definitely. She was definitely one of many water people.
I was retweeted a Vimeo video today that I'll try to embed in this this post of behind the scenes of Fantasia 2000, where they have this like Flight of the Phoenix bird that bursts out of a volcano. And because it was Fantasia 2000, I was assumed it was a whole bunch of computer effects, but it's actually one of like Disney's old school animation special effects guys, like going in and doing layers of smoke and, you know, layers of splash and making sure the gravity on all the lava bits is like correct. And it's amazing to watch these pencils like sort of become something that should be CG. So like the weird space in between like real physics and animation physics and how real water and, you know, liquids look and how they could look in animated movies have now like clashed in this weird thing where I can't say it looked real, but it looked right the entire time.
I'm so glad we got to do this podcast episode for Dave Bali Gonzalez, even though this isn't really about polygons. I have a question for you. Why do you think, I mean, maybe Kubo specifically, but why do you think Leica movies aren't more popular than they are?
Well, I mean, they're like not the most popular one is an adaptation of something that people already knew. And I think for children's movies, which is how they come off, because stop-motion animation is actually probably financially better doing children's movies, if Animalisa is any indication. They are really complex. And so it's the kind of thing that if a adult isn't introducing it to you, a kid's not going to look at Kubo and say, like, let's see Kubo. And then I saw it with some kids. And I guarantee you none of them walked out and told their friends to see Kubo. I just think it's paced for adults. And, you know, I'm not saying that kids' movies, you know, have to be, like, completely different. But I think it's, like, a truly four-quadrant movie in how it's paced. And that means leaving off younger children who maybe shouldn't be going to the movie theater or something.
I have a theory.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
And this is a real hot take, because we talk about wanting more originality in Hollywood.
Right.
I think there is an element to Leica where they're telling these original stories. And what I would argue they do is more of a cultural adaptation thing. You know, like for Paranorman, they adapted the concept of Halloween and zombies. And then for Kubo, obviously, it's Japanese samurai tale. And so I think the originality of their movies might actually hamper them because they're not tied to an existing thing.
Right.
You know, that's why Coraline, you could see a clear benefit that Coraline had of being based on a Neil Gaiman book. And yeah, I think that's a problem.
But do you think there's room for it to endure? Like, okay, when we were kids, the person doing this was Jim Henson. And so you would get Labyrinth and you would get The Dark Crystal, which are super weird, paced weirdly for children movies, but have become like so important to so many people my age that I'm wondering if Leica movies will become that for anyone.
Yes.
Or if they're still even in a weirder valley of...
I mean, I look at these movies like they are the, they're like the sort of slightly larger budget indie movie of animation. So if you compare, like if we compare this movie with Finding Dory, which was Pixar's movie this year. One, Finding Dory is a sequel, which Travis Knight said Laika does not do sequels. Anyway, but so you look at the comparison of the budget, Finding Dory was a $200 million movie, and Kubo is a $60 million movie. So it really is big budget versus indie, and I feel like these are the indie, almost Criterion Collection animated movies, so that as people get older and they start to appreciate and study the craft of cinema, these are the movies you'd rather watch than a sequel to a Pixar movie. Like those original Pixar movies, sure, because of their place in history. But these do feel like the kind of movies that will have lasting power. And I think that their box office actually shows that. Like I was looking at the box office for them, for Laika, and they're not they're not huge openers. In fact, Kubo's opening was only $4 million less than Coraline's. But they have really interesting staying power, and they perform really well across all kinds of different markets. So it's interesting that we look at Kubo now and we're like, man, this really didn't open that well.
You're right. It really, the opening weekend is not. Yeah,
they're really not a big opening weekend. I think they are kind of the indie mainstay of making animated films. And that really does also feel like their vibe, too, where it's like they are this studio in Portland that's kind of away from Hollywood, and they do their own thing and they option weird properties. Like I think one of their options is the singer of the Decemberists wrote a book called Wildwood. That's one of the things they
have. Colin Malloy. That's a good book.
Yeah.
That's a great book.
So they have that one.
That's a very Portland book for sure.
Yeah. I mean, so they do their own thing, and I think that this is interesting because it kind of ties into what Dave and the other gentlemen were talking about on Fitwear this week, which was, is the middle gone of Hollywood? You know, you have these huge budget movies, and then you have movies that are made for a couple million dollars to go to Sundance. Laika's movies are kind of the middle. You know, they're the $60 million movies that at best make like $120 million at the box office, and they just get to keep making more movies. And they're making things that no one else is making.
And I think why I would support Laika over something like horror, which I supported on the other podcast in a marketing way, is because I feel like Laika movies are, I mean, I wasn't big into Labyrinth, but I did love Dark Crystal, if we're going to talk Jim Henson thing, which has a similar... Mm-hmm. This is what I want to make, and I'm going to put all of my, you know, craftsmanship into it. And I think those movies end up being really important to people that see them, whereas I think Secret Life of Pets, sees.
I was about to bring up Secret Life of Pets as, like, the anti-Laika. I guess it's just up to me to, like, either procreate or bully other people's children, but, like, I just want all the children in the world to see Kubo instead of Secret Life of Pets. I'll defend some other mainstream, like, I love Zootopia. I think it's a great movie. I think people should see it. I enjoy all of the Kung Fu Pandas, which Dave and I have talked about, but, like, something like Secret Life of Pets, or there was a trailer for some, like, horrible animated, like, karaoke movie with, like, pigs.
By the same people who see Secret Life of Pets. Just don't trust that studio.
It looked like...
Oh, those
like
poor Minions people.
It's like the... Or Minions drive me crazy. Anyway, so that's my snobbery coming through. I would like all of you, if you know a child... Please know that child before you grab them and take them to the movies. But know a child, grab them, take them to see these movies. Some people have asked me, because I was pushing really hard for Pete's Dragon the other week, and a lot of people asked me if it was appropriate for children. All of the Laika movies are rated PG. I can't believe Coraline's rated PG. I always watch movies now with my very sensitive nephew in mind. I think some children would be sensitive to Kubo, especially like when Ray finds his dragon, moon dragon thing, like takes up the entire screen, is like, everyone you love is dead. Like, it was a lot.
I mean, kids need to confront these essential truths about the human experience, but yeah, I can see.
And it helps if they're just visually terrified so they don't hear the existential terror.
I do think you raised an interesting point, though, about movies like Secret Life of Pets and Minions and even Zootopia. So, like, those movies, there's almost a sliding scale of art and commerce where I feel like Kubo and Box Trolls and all the Laika movies swing closer to art, whereas Zootopia, even though it is a good movie, it is a lot of craftsmanship went into it, it swings a little bit closer to commerce. So,
oh, certainly.
While, yeah. You know, like, I like the Minions, both of them. They were both fun. And the one before that, which I, what was it called?
Despicable Me.
Also very charming, but very digestible and very ultimately forgettable. It's the kind of movie that if it were on HBO and I didn't have anything else to watch, I could turn it on and enjoy. But I love the Box Trolls. Like, I will grab people. Like, I made my roommates watch this. You know, Coraline, I remember going to see. Like, I remember the day that I saw it. I was at home in Cleveland. I took my mom, and she had always hated 3D movies, and she just loved it. And she still brings it up to this day, you know, 6-7 years later, about, remember when we went to see Coraline on that weird afternoon where it was kind of rainy? And that was great, wasn't it? And I was like, yeah, you know, it's like there's a different impact that these movies have that I think is important to note, even though they're small.
I did love that. How, I mean, when did they open? Okay, so they've opened like February, August, September, August. Like, but I think all like a movie should open in the fall, like in the fall. They feel like fall movies to me. I mean, especially, I guess, Paranorman. But I remember that Halloween 2009, seeing so many young women dressed up as Coraline, and not book Coraline, because movie Coraline has blue hair, book Coraline does not. Like,
oh man, we
dressed
got some
up as
book nerd stuff in.
as like movie Coraline, and like, it making my heart full. I was so sad that I never once saw a Box Troll at Halloween, but I would love to see a Box Troll.
I might go as a Box Troll this year.
You should
go as Fish. But I really do think that this is the animated world's like Criterion snobby art film. But they're really good. It's the film that you kind of have to defend to other people sometimes. It's like, oh, you're just being kind of like a snobby person. It's like, no, they're really good movies. Like, I've never had anyone tell me, oh my God, that was terrible, or why did you recommend Coraline to me?
Well, even since Coraline, which is 2009, so we've had like 7 years now, if it's a Laika movie, you could roll the dice on it and walk away having at least ingested something that's worthwhile.
Right.
Even if you didn't like it, I'm sure that you saw something that you're better off having seen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think Paranorman is like pretty far and away my least favorite Laika movie.
God, you're and a monster.
Yeah, I am a monster. But I don't like horror. And it's
the one with Anna Kendrick.
That's horror. Okay.
You could be a monster. That's what Paranorman is all about.
And the best friend named Neil. Come on.
I'm a bad person. It's okay. But I mean, I like it, but I still like it. It's still a good, maybe even great movie. But it's not something that I wanted to revisit. I've revisited, well, I haven't revisited Kubo yet since I saw it this afternoon by myself, but in the completely empty theater. Granted, it's noon on like a Tuesday. But anyway, point being, you're right, Dave. They're all great movies, even the one that I don't like very
much. They've all been nominated for an Academy Award, right?
Yep. That's gonna happen again too.
Yep.
Like that, like I said, top. That's happening because it's
so. What do you think?
Amazing.
What do you think it's gonna be? So how many slots are in that category? Because I feel like one year is just three.
It can be 3 to 5, I think.
Okay.
Wait, hold
so
on.
Let me see. Definitely Dory.
I'd say Dory, Zootopia, this one, Kubo.
Oh, yeah, it's 5.
I want to feel like there's something. I feel like there's something that I'm forgetting from the end of this year.
Is Little Prince this year released?
No, Prince might be out there yet.
Did it get a theatrical release? I thought it just popped onto Netflix. Little Prince is also magical, guys. See it.
Anyway, for sure that it's going to be a category that I watch every year, and this is going to be in it. There's no way that they're going to be like, Blue Skies Peanuts was by far a technical achievement worth. No.
I mean, I think Dory's going to win, which sucks because Kubo should win. So,
well,
anyway.
We've already seen that, you know, in case you guys wonder why I hate Brave, it's because it beat Paranorman at the Academy Awards that year. So, yeah, that set me off on a year-long hatred of Bears.
I didn't know that's why you hated Brave. I thought you just hated Bears.
No, because when we when we say something's the best and overlook something like Paranorman in favor of Brave, which is like the Suicide Squad of Pixar movies.
Whoa.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. The Cars series exists and Planes. But like, Jesus, like Paranorman was beautiful and handmade and said something about being bullied, which I think a lot of people needed to hear in 2012. And
they probably
you
could
know,
still use a little.
Brave said, if you have trouble with your mom, turn her into a bear. Oh, and sew all ripped tapestries, because otherwise it might be important. Spoilers for Brave.
Side note, since I took the time to look it up, The Little Prince did release in theaters on August 5th.
All right, okay. So it probably, qualifies. Be in there.
It should. It's good.
But yeah, I mean, you're right on the thematic stuff with Brave. It's problematic.
Yeah. Good. I'm glad we won that battle 4 years later, because I've been fighting hard the entire time.
I will watch Paranorman again. How about
it's
that?
It's delightful.
Yeah, it's got a Dizzy Rascal dance breakdown in the middle of it. It's so great.
Okay.
Basically, the theme of this podcast is, here are four movies you should definitely watch, starting with Kubo.
I know. Yeah. If you haven't seen these four movies, feel bad about yourself. Also, grab every child you see, but children you know.
Well, if you don't have children, I think Paranorman's plot might also be the plot of American Horror Story Season 6. So, you know, do some background research.
Oh, Dave and his yarn walls. Oh, okay. anything else you want to talk about, Laika-wise?
No, I think... I think Neil's favorite is the Box Trolls, right? Mine's Paranorman. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Joanna, Box Trolls, Coraline, Kubo?
It's Box Trolls, unless when I watch Kubo again, it's Kubo. But it's Box Trolls right now. Mm. I've seen Box Trolls so many times.
Nice. Box Trolls is adorable. It's all about cheese.
Yeah.
I love cheese.
It's about cheese and orphans and parents who don't pay attention to their children. So good.
Need to rewatch the Box Trolls.
That's the best. That's also the best Elle Fanning performance ever. So, you know, just saying.
What? You didn't like Hound Dog? You monster.
That's Dakota, isn't it?
Oh, God. Who cares? I don't.
You can't take a Fanning sister stand and then get the wrong one.
It's a Fanning.
I just want credit for having seen Hound Dog. I think I was one of the two dozen that did.
No, I've seen. I will tell a Hound Dog story really quickly. I was an usher volunteer at Sundance when Hound Dog premiered. I saw Hound Dog 5 times, because you have to be in the theater when the movie shows, and if you're at certain venues, they just show the same movies over and over again. And for 2 of those times, I was in the theater, but in a place where I couldn't see the screen, so I just had to listen to Hound Dog twice. So
okay,
I get extra credit.
No, here's my counterpoint. I was working as a script reader for a production company that will remain nameless that passed on Hound Dog twice after giving notes, and then another company made it, and I went and saw it. So I experienced 2 worse versions of Hound Dog, and then the actual version of Hound Dog.
Oh, boy.
Hound Dog. If you want to see a crappy movie at some point, we've picked one out for you.
Nice. But go see Kubo, because it's great.
Speaking of, Neil, where are we going to head next week for real homework we should give people?
Next week is super fun. This is, I would say, other than Stranger Things, which we did last week, this is the second most requested topic of the summer. I guess if we had been taking requests prior to Game of Thrones season, this would have been number one. And we are going to Yorktown. Because we are not throwing away our shot, and we are going to talk Hamilton and the adaptation of someone's life into a hip-hop musical. It's going to be
indeed.
So fun. And
and you guys really need to listen to the show on audio if you can. If you want to read the book, Hamilton, The Revolution. It's about the making of the show, and it's the text of the show. But to next week is going to be so filthy with inside references and jokes that we think are really clever that you really need to be, you know, up to date on your Hamilton.
Right. And we have... I have not seen the show. Have either of you?
I have not seen the show.
Joanna saw it, right?
I saw it, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll have a little firsthand.
I'm the monster again who saw Hamilton.
So deep jealousy. Deep jealousy until next week. But it should be a fun episode.
We have one listener who said they saw it, I think, 3 or 4 times, which is just crazy pants.
That listener owes us a 5-star review because of the jealousy factor.
Yeah. So, yeah, some singing next week, I'm sure. And talking about politics and hip-hop culture, I doubt that we're going to say anything weird or controversial in that discussion.
I doubt that we're going to talk election 2016 at all.
None of the issues of American politics bleeding into a pop culture podcast are going to cause any sort of controversy.
So
next week,
gird your loins.
It's gonna be crazy. So until then, guys, while you're loin girding, Joanna, where can people find more of you on the internet?
Whilst you're loin girding,
you can
find me on vanityfair.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, or you can hear me talking generally. Usually I'm fighting in the worm, though not this week, and on the Little Gold Men podcast.
And Mr. Neil Miller?
You can find me writing stuff at filmschoolrejects.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Rejects. And make sure to follow us on Twitter at Storm of Spoilers. I have planned to share a bunch of cool Leica videos throughout the week. So a bunch of behind-the-scenes stuff that will help reinforce what we talked about this week.
Yes. And I'm Dave Gonzalez. I spell my first name, D-A-7-E. That is also my Twitter handle. I blog at geek.com and put all my podcasting material at fightinginthewarroom.com. And,
I may not live to see our glory.
I may not live to see our glory.
But I will gladly join the fight.
But I will gladly join the fight.
And when our children tell our story.
And when our children tell our story.
They'll tell the story of tonight.
Let's have another round tonight.
Let's have another round tonight.
Let's have another round tonight.
Raise a glass to freedom. Something they can never take away. No matter what they tell you, raise a glass to the four of us. Tomorrow there'll be more of us telling the story of tonight.
They'll tell the story of tonight.
Raise a glass to freedom, something they can never take away.
No matter what they tell you.
Let's have another round tonight.
Raise a glass to the four of us.
Tomorrow there'll be more of us
telling the story of tonight.
Let's have another round tonight.
They'll tell the story of tonight.
Raise a glass to freedom.
They'll tell the story of tonight.
Raise a glass to freedom.
They'll tell the story of tonight.